You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
God bless the people who cannot raise their voice. We can chase down all our enemies, bring
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore. This week, I'm reminded of how much incredible humanity and courage exists in our world, and I honor the humanity and courage of Mordechai Vanunu. Born in Marrakesh, Morocco, in 1954, Mordechai Vanunu is an Israeli former nuclear technician who revealed details of Israel's nuclear weapons program to the British press in 1986. He was subsequently lured to Italy and kidnapped by Israeli agents, transported to Israel, and convicted of treason. Mordechai Vanunu spent 18 years in prison, most of which were in solitary confinement. Vanunu was released from prison in 2004 and subject to a broad array of restrictions on his speech and movement. Since then, he has been briefly arrested several times for violations of those restrictions, including giving interviews to foreign journalists and attempting to leave Israel. In 2007, Vanunu was sentenced to 6 months in prison for violating terms of his parole. The sentence was considered unusual, even by the prosecution, who expected a suspended sentence. In response, Amnesty International issued a press release on 2nd of July 2007, stating that the organization considers Mordechai Vanunu to be a prisoner of conscience and calls for his immediate, unconditional release. Vanunu has been characterized by some as a whistleblower and by others as a traitor. He is considered by many Europeans as a hero of the nuclear age and has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize every year from 1988 to 2004. Nominated again this year, he wrote the following letter. Dear Nobel Peace Prize Committee in Oslo, I am Mordechai Vanunu, who has been nominated several times to the Nobel Peace Prize, also this year's 2009 award. I am asking the committee to remove my name from the list for this year's list of nominations. My main reason for this is that I cannot be part of a list of laureates that includes Shimon Peres. He is the man who was behind all the Israeli atomic policy. Peres established and developed the atomic weapon program in Dimona in Israel. Exactly like Dr. Khan did in Pakistan, Peres was the man behind the atomic weapon proliferation to South Africa and other states. He was also, for instance, behind the nuclear weapon test in South Africa in 1978. Peres was the man who ordered the kidnapping of me in Italy, Rome, September 30, 1986, and for the secret trial and sentencing of me as a spy and traitor for 18 years in isolation in prison in Israel. Until now, he continues to oppose my freedom and release, in spite of my serving my full sentence of 18 years. From all these reasons, I don't want to be nominated, and I will not accept the nomination. I say no to any nomination as long as I am not free, that is, as long as I am still forced to be in Israel. He ends the letter with, "What I want is freedom, and only freedom."
Power to the peaceful. Love to the peaceful young, I sing. Power to the peaceful. Love to the peaceful.
March 19th was the 6th anniversary of the invasion and occupation of Iraq. We'll begin our hour today with Seth Manzel, a former Army infantryman deployed to Iraq and currently executive director of GI Voice based in Washington State. We'll also hear from Farima Joya, co-founder of Berkeley Bamyan Education Foundation. Farima Joya was born in Afghanistan and left her homeland with her family in 1983. Farima Joya will help us understand something about a country that the U.S. has been engaged with militarily since October the 7th, 2001, the day we began a bombing campaign that was supposed to taper off around about 2001. Here we are in 2009, and the bombing continues, and we actually do not have an anniversary of the beginning of that military campaign. We'll begin today with Iraq War veteran Seth Manzel, a former Army infantryman deployed to Iraq. He's executive director of GI Voice, based in Washington State. I asked him what this sixth anniversary of the beginning of the war in Iraq means to him.
You know, it means that we as a movement have kind of failed 6 years in a row to end this this really horrible occupation that we're engaged in. I was deployed for a year from 2004 to 2005. And in my wildest dreams, when I was there, I never imagined that it would still be going now, and we'd still be doing the same thing over and over again for this long. It's really just a horrible concept.
Seth, you were in the Army?
Yes, I was in the Army Infantry.
Okay, so talk a little bit about how you came to view this war.
I was against the war when it first started. I was against the occupation of Afghanistan that when I joined, the war in Iraq hadn't begun yet, but it was quite obvious that it would start soon. I joined the Army after 9/11 because I had lost my job and really didn't have any other options financially. But yeah, being over in Iraq really solidified my views about that. I mean, I had a vague academic idea that you know, the American occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq was wrong, but I didn't know it I didn't know the realities of the things that happened, the torture, the mistreatment of prisoners. You know, I'd heard about them on the news, but just to see them firsthand is it's pretty appalling. And I think when I came back, I was very I wasn't sure really what to do with the feelings that I had about the things that we had been doing over there.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that it was difficult to talk to people back here about it?
I think that the main thing was that most people on a one basis don't want to hear what's happening over there.
Yeah.
And really, I think the average person on the street, and they don't want to know what has to happen for them to have, you know, to have one of the highest living standards in the world. Just like you don't want to see the back room of the butcher shop.
If we actually paid attention, we would not allow these kinds of things to continue.
Yeah, absolutely. I think most veterans, regardless of their feelings about the war, come back and find that that's the case. That first of all, they don't, no one wants to hear what happened, and second of all, they don't feel very comfortable speaking to people about it because people have no basis to understand the specifics of what that person's experience was.
And so you came back and you started GI Voice?
Yes, I formed the GI Voice project with myself, another veteran, Alex Bacon, who had been with the Coast Guard, and two professors from Evergreen State College and several supporters from the local community. We formed the GI Voice Project. It was originally an online radio station on a website. The online radio station isn't up at the moment, but we've branched out into having a coffee shop right across the interstate from Fort Lewis that is frequented by soldiers pretty regularly.
And when you started that coffee shop, were you aware of the history of coffee shops during the Vietnam resistance to that war?
Yes, I think the movie Sir, No Sir kind of inspired us to, pursue that avenue, and I'm very happy that we did, because, we're serving, scores of soldiers every week, and we're in contact with with the people who are actually in position to do something about the wars.
So, talk a little bit about your typical GI who comes into the Coffee Strong coffee shop.
Well, I mean, most soldiers, especially enlisted people, are not treated all that well. Their day-to-day life is you know, it's hit and miss, but most of them are not not in that great a situation in their life. They didn't get most people didn't join the military out of any, you know, sense of patriotism or idealism, and they joined because they needed money. And you know, the Army is one of the few places where someone without a college education, today's economy, even someone with a college education, can make a halfway decent living wage. But you know, most soldiers with families qualify for state aid and welfare. Even like non-commissioned officers, their families qualify to be on food stamps many times. So we're not talking about really great pay, especially considering the amount of hours that one puts into that job. Mm-hmm. and the amount of risk involved. There's a lot of dissent in the Army, a lot of discontent with, you know, how they're being treated, and a lot of sexism in the Army. Military rape is very common. You know, 1 in 3 women during their military careers are sexually assaulted. So I think generally most people in the Army aren't that happy with their situation. Mm-hmm. Coming in and to a place where they can be comfortable with, you know, talking about these issues, you know, and expressing some kind of, you know, so expressing their feelings about their situation is, I think, liberating for a lot of them. I mean, you know, I see a lot of people just come in and unload and you know, say, you know, I'm tired of being treated like crap. I've been deployed 4 times and I got stop lost. We literally had a soldier come in yesterday who had been deployed 4 times and was being stop lost again. He was about to get out of the military and he was stop lost again. You know, these ridiculous situations that most people never are completely unaware that soldiers go through, you know, have these kinds of issues. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're so common, and it's really staggering when you know, take a step back and look at the scale of you know, how many people are being negatively affected by having signed up for the military.
Yeah, and then Obama has just agreed that he's going to stop the Stop Loss program, but only in 2010.
You know, under Obama, he's made a lot of promises, and I mean, there's actually been a net increase in violence since Obama's taken office. You know, on the part of the United States. I mean, we've increased our attacks on our nuclear ally, Pakistan. You know, and how many times did Bush say he was going to, you know, hint that he would get us out of Iraq, you know, in a certain number of months, and it never happened. You know, the fact that Obama's made some promises shouldn't really get us too excited.
If you're in the military now, I mean, it's a horror to think of having to go, like you said, with this fellow who's going back now for his 5th time, right?
Yeah, he would have been going back for his 5th time. And I've been out of the Army for 2 years, and I just recently received orders in the mail to go to Afghanistan. So I'm certainly not holding my breath with Obama.
And you're beginning to see a lot of that people like yourself have been out for some time and they're starting to get called back?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm very fortunate in that I have a disability rating, and I own a small business, so I'll probably be exempted from having to go. But you know, I have lots of friends who don't have that at their disposal, and they basically have to choose whether or not to refuse those orders, or, you know, whether or not they want to go to spend a year in Afghanistan. And you know, as far as refusing those orders, these are orders that come from the individual ready reserve. Refusing those orders don't affect a person's VA benefits. You're not, you know, people aren't getting arrested because they refuse those orders. Mm-hmm. There's very little consequence for refusing those orders. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if people get those orders, they should definitely consult the GI rights hotline or urge to resist.
Let's plug those two again. I've actually worked with both of those groups, the GIRightsHotline.org.
Yes, and CourageToResist.org.
To get more information, the GI Rights Hotline actually has a lot of information about all sorts of. If you have any kinds of medical questions or family questions, or they're very comprehensive in their information, so definitely call those. So, what do you think when you see the protesters out today, yesterday, and for the next couple of days?
I really hope that we can muster the numbers that are necessary to get people's attention. You know, protesting just has to be the first step. I mean, we need to recognize that we need to get as many people in the street as possible, but we also need to recognize that protesting alone is not going to end the war, or, you know, writing our congressmen and women is not going to end the war. Mm-hmm. These wars are way too profitable for companies like Microsoft and Boeing and General Dynamics and General Motors. They all make too much money off of these wars, and these are the companies who make the major campaign contributions that you and I could never compete with. So, you know, it's good to be put pressure on our representatives, but it's these companies that are making money off of it. You know, they're the ones that really benefit from it, and they're the ones that are really keeping this war going.
That's the rub, isn't it? That's kind of the unspoken reality of this. It's hard to know how to approach that, especially in an economic downturn where people are really worried about their financial situation. It seems like if we can have a small contingent of people fighting over there and it makes the United States budget better looking, then why the heck not?
Most of these war profiteers, these companies, when they get profits when soldiers die, those profits don't just go to Americans, they go to international investors. You know, most of the people who work in chow halls in Iraq and Afghanistan are not Americans, but you know, people from Thailand, people from India, you know, people who are making next to nothing. You know, that money isn't going into Americans' pockets. It's minuscule amount of it is going into the pockets of some people who live in other countries. Then the rest of that is going to, you know, for corporate profits. You know, executives and investors are gobbling up the rest of that. So it's not as though that's going to, you know, war profiteering isn't going to help out the economy. And war profiteering doesn't benefit the United States at all. I mean, if Al-Qaeda had more money, I'm sure that Kellogg, Brown, and Root would be working with them. And I know that sounds pretty far out there. But during World War II, International Business Machine, IBM, was making guns, M1 carbines, for American soldiers to use to kill Nazis. At the same time, they were making punch card machines for the Nazis to track Jews from the ghettos to the gas chambers. So they were playing both sides there and profiting off of both sides. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these companies are completely amoral. They're worried about making money for their investors. And that is the purpose they're here for. They have no patriotic motive. When Microsoft makes software to go on a striker, you know, the best thing that can possibly happen for them is, you know, for that striker to be destroyed. And the soldiers inside, you know, who cares from their point of view what happens to them? Because they just want to sell another copy of that software to the United States government.
Mm-hmm. Seth Manzel, how was it for you when you started learning about how this world functions in the way you've just described?
I think I had a bit of a handle on it before I went, but it's so clear once you're over there. You know, in Iraq, whenever you walk around on a FOB, a forward operating base, you know, everything is marked a property of Kellogg, Brown, and Root. Kellogg, Brown, and Root is the spinoff from Halliburton that actually moved their corporate headquarters to Dubai to avoid scrutiny, legal scrutiny of their financial dealings and, you know, whether or not they had fulfilled their contracts properly. But they continue to get contracts to serve the U.S. military. It's pretty blatant when you're over there and you see that there's Harley Davidson representatives trying to sell bikes to soldiers. There's General Motors representatives there to sell cars to people who never had this much money in their life. They're trying to capitalize on that and get their cut. It's so blatant when you're over there that you can't miss it.
Let's say that yes, your average American is somewhat aware, but really not aware enough or not concerned enough to protest these corporations, protest the way the system is working currently. How can we stimulate them enough to understand that this is their life also?
All they need to do is, lose their insurance when they lose their job, which, you know, we're almost getting into double-digit unemployment now. These people are seeing the direct effects of these wars because, you know, that money that's not going into our healthcare system is going to fight wars in Iraq to, so that we can maintain control of oil over there. Their kids aren't getting a very good education, and they can see that children in other countries, people in other countries are getting jobs that Americans once got because the educational system here is so horrible. That's the effect of the war. So this is something that should outrage everyone. When they just look at how much these contracts are and think about what, that could be building hospitals, that could be building roads, that could be used to employ American workers in good paying jobs that'll allow people to hold on to the houses that they're in the process of losing. There's so much that that we're missing out on in this country just simply because we would rather spend the money establishing our global dominance, I guess.
Seth, how can people get directly in touch with you as the director of GI Voice?
They can email me through our website, givoice.com, or coffeestrong.com. They can also support the Coffee House Project. You can also call at 253-228-8912.
And thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you, and have a nice day.
That was Seth Manzel, former Army infantryman deployed to Iraq. He's executive director of GI Voice, based in Washington State. For the last 6 years, the war in Iraq has taken center stage while Afghans in Afghanistan has barely been mentioned. Back in 2001, MSNBC reported that some, like counterterrorism czar Richard Clark, later criticized the amount of time before the bombings could start in Afghanistan. Shortly after 9/11, Clark was made co-chairman of an interagency committee to devise responses to al-Qaeda. He advocated a rapid, no-holds-barred retaliation in Afghanistan, including sending troops to immediately seal off Afghanistan's borders and cut off escape routes. The Bush administration decided to focus on air power, and F-16 jet fighters and a B-1 bomber dropped bombs on a Pakistani Frontier Corps border checkpoint, killing at least 11 soldiers and setting off outrage in Pakistan. Since then, at least two missile attacks launched from U.S. drones have killed people in Pakistan's northwest borderlands. January 23rd of 2009, it's 2 days after our president took office after being elected because of his anti-war stance, a missile killed at least 15 in Mir Ali village in North Waziristan. Pakistani government officials issued a statement saying the attack destroyed the house of a man identified as Khalil Dawar and killed 8 people. In the second attack, missiles struck a house near the village of Wana, South Waziristan, killing 7, according to local accounts. Reports said 3 of the dead were children. Today, with President Obama vowing to send 17,000 more U.S. troops there, most Americans are still woefully unprepared to understand this country whose history dates back several thousand years. With me today is Farima Joya, co-founder of Berkeley Bamiyan Education Foundation, who was born in Afghanistan and left with her family in 1983. We began by acknowledging the lack of basic understanding in the United States about her homeland.
Well, thank you very much, Susan, for having me, actually. And to tell you the truth, I really can't believe that there are still a lot of misunderstanding. And Afghanistan still is not on the map, actually, for a lot of people. And I will try my best, actually, to clarify a lot of things. I was born and raised in Kabul. And Afghanistan, as a lot of people would probably know, back then, it's much more a tribal country. Even the modern Kabul, it was a tribal country. Very quiet. Everybody was minding their own business. What we had actually that caused us this whole problem was that lack of modernization, lack of education, and leaving people to just do whatever they felt like it. Oppression of women, actually. not having a freedom of speech for I would say probably 100 or maybe 60 years or so, if we look back, there were people in Afghanistan that actually wanted to bring education, bring modernization, bring freedom of choice for women, bring actually, I mean, end oppression of women, but they were just imprisoned, they were killed, they were sent out of the country. I mean, for instance, there was a lot of people actually trying to work these things, I mean, work for the community, for Afghanistan. But unfortunately, we had a lot of corruption in our government. We had a government who was not really interested in raising the standard of living for majority of Afghans. I mean, now to think about it, they just, you know, wanted their own peace and quiet. They just wanted to rule the country. Mm-hmm. And that was the best way to do it, to just keep people in dark, actually.
And describe what you mean by tribalism. There's, I think, a lot of different ways of understanding that. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that every region of Afghanistan is occupied by a certain people. Like, for instance, the Pashtuns in the south, the Uzbeks and Turkmens in the north, the Tajiks in the Kabul in the middle of Afghanistan, the Hazaras in the middle of Afghanistan. Every tribe or every community had their own specific region that they were living in. You know, when I lived in Kabul, actually, I lived in an area where all my neighbors were from different ethnicities, but we lived really peacefully. And everybody was minding their own business, their own thing. I would say Kabul probably is much more open-minded than a lot of other places in, mm-hmm. in Afghanistan, like in villages and other states. But that is my understanding, actually.
So people were in their ethnic groups, but there wasn't a lot of friction. People were finding a way to live together most of the time.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
But the government wasn't really supporting that. They weren't. How would you support, if you were a government, how would you support different ethnic groups?
Okay, well, the government actually was running by Pashtuns that were trying to leave other ethnicities in the dark, actually, or actually they wanted to have their own dominance. Like, for instance, I'm not a Pashtun. I'm a Tajik. I'm not even a Tajik. I'm a little small ethnicity that is within the Tajik, probably, but I'm not part of the majority. I was always the minority. We were always the minority in Afghanistan. Like, for instance, people who are from the Shia, they were not allowed to be in the military because, you know, again, it's the power issue. So actually, a lot of people who were actually tried to go into politics from our side of the families or tribes, if I put it that way, they were killed or imprisoned or, imprisoned in their homes or asked to leave the country. So that's what happened, actually. Now, the dominance, or the Pashtun who were in the dominance in the country, they tried to keep all the power to themselves. That's how they kept ruling.
And yet the ordinary people were able to live with these different ethnicities without a lot of problems, is what I'm hearing you say.
On the surface, yes. As long as nobody actually poked them or, for instance, interfere with their business or their way of living. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, the South has one kind of rules and regulations among themselves, actually. The North has some other ones, and the Hazaras have some other ones. As long as somebody does not interfere with the way of their living, they can live together. But deep down, there was a lot of problems. There was a lot of miscommunication, mistrusting.
Perhaps what you're suggesting now is what we're seeing in Afghanistan now with these different warlords, tribal groups, all of that has come to the surface. All of what was submerged at one point has perhaps come to the surface. Is that what you're saying?
No, not really, actually. The problem that is created today is not because of our tribalism. Tribalism exists even in the United States right now. I mean, it's everywhere. If you see it, and everywhere. In Europe, in the United States, and everywhere. But the problem that is not actually that people cannot live side by side. The problem is that a lot of lack of education, actually, I believe, really caused a lot of problems for us. If we look at back when the problem started, actually, was when a group of people wanted to defend the country against the Soviet Union, and they left into Pakistan to go back and fight. That's when, actually, one brother left to go to Pakistan and be part of the jihad, mm-hmm. and the other brother stayed in Afghanistan, and he had to deal with whatever he has to do. So then the two brothers were fighting. I mean, I'm not even mm-hmm. talking about the tribalism. That's not the majority mm-hmm. of the problem that we are facing right now. Or that's not actually how to look into to solve this problem. I'm sure that people will be living side by side peacefully once again in Afghanistan, just as it is in every other country of the world.
Freema, I want to go back for a moment and ask you to talk a little more about the comment you made about tribalism exists in the United States. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that there are whites, there are Asians of Middle East descent, there are Mexicans, there are Spanish, there are Irish, these are what you call races, different races. They stick together. There's Christians, they stick together. There are Muslims, they stick together. There are Jewish, they stick together. I mean, they have their own rules, their own cultures within themselves. But still, yet you and I are sitting right here and we're talking, right? Based on an agreement that we are having a conversation without actually thinking how you perceive me or how I perceive you.
So the unspoken agreement is that we will keep all of the repressed parts of perhaps what might happen between us outside of this conversation. And that's what we do when we try and communicate across, let's call them tribes or tribal or ethnic backgrounds.
Don't everybody have a need to live side by side? Not everybody in the world agree on everything that is going on. But then if we have to live together, we have to respect each other.
We have to respect each other. I mean, I'm kind of pushing this point because I think this gets lost a lot. Here we tend to just ignore things that we don't want to deal with.
Well, the way I see it is that the world is not really a fair game or a fair world. What you wish probably is different from what I wish. But then we have a certain agreement or certain rules of humanities that we can just live together side by side, thinking that you respect something and I respect something. And if I don't respect for your ideas, for your values, then it's a problem. We cannot live together. Here, it's not a matter of ignorance. It's not that we are ignoring the problems. It's that we are accepting the problems. It's not a problem, actually. We're accepting
the
disagreement.
I like that positioning. You're right.
We're accepting the disagreement. Mm-hmm. We're agreeing to disagree.
And
basically,
it's not a big problem.
And it's not a big problem. I mean, back then in Afghanistan we were agreeing with our neighbors to disagree on some issues.
Mm-hmm.
How to raise your kids. How to, for instance, cook your meal. Or how to, for instance, deal with your parents, for instance. Or I am living in a neighborhood of my neighbors are from all different ethnicities and backgrounds, and everyone knows their own what is best for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to agree with that, or I have to respect them. I can't tell them, no, you're doing it wrong. Otherwise, I can't live in that street.
And so what happens when we no longer want to play by those rules, or we no longer want to accept that, we take on a position that our way is best, and that our religion or our
values or our value system or our moral system is the best, this is where we start getting into problems. And this is what you're seeing?
Exactly, exactly. When the minute we see that we are right, you're wrong, the minute that we see that we can do things better than you do, that's when we go wrong. Mm-hmm.
And then you mentioned the part that education plays in this, and you're co-founder of a group called Berkeley Bamiyan Education Foundation. How did it start?
Well, actually, we're a group of people that we really see that education is the basic thing for raising the standard of living. I feel like the people in Afghanistan, kids, women especially, they were left behind from schools. They were not really taught. People are really eager to learn in Afghanistan. They want to learn computers, they want to learn science, they want to learn other countries, you know, geography, history, everything. But this is not an opportunity for them. Right here in the United States, the opportunity is here. The school is here. The books are here. The computers are here. Every kid, everybody, old and young, they have an opportunity, they have a chance to go and learn whatever they want to learn, actually. It's up to them, personally, if they don't want to go study something. Mm-hmm. But in Afghanistan, this is not an option, actually, for many, many reasons. So one of the goals that BBEF, or Berkeley Bamiyan Education Foundation, has is that Bamiyan, first of all, we're going to talk a little bit in detail about this one. Bamiyan is really a city, in a university city, a city that is lacking actually a lot of attention from our government, because the people who are living there, the Hazaras, are the least bit favorite people of anybody in Afghanistan. I mean, the government really doesn't see them as a threat. They're hardworking people. There's a university. They have a passion for learning. So that's where it starts, actually. That's where I think it starts, by educating people. See, the literacy rate in Bamiyan, actually, is 30% for young male, mm-hmm. 5% female. Mm. So that's where we started to, I mean, actually put the basics back in education and support the people who want to learn. There are a lot of young girls who are staying at home who want to learn. They're eager to learn. There should be an opportunity for them to just go, you know, just read and write.
It's hard for us to understand that there's perhaps computers are lacking.
I'm not saying computers and internet, actually. These are very modern technologies. I'm not saying that it's not there, but probably Bamiyan probably will have maybe, I don't know, if I'm not exaggerating here, maybe about 10 computers in the University of Bamiyan who can actually access internet. Mm-hmm. But I'm talking about real classroom, notebooks, pens, teachers. They don't even have to have chairs, furniture to go into school. They are just sitting on the floor and with a very minimum thing that we can provide them, with a notebook and pen.
So at this point, schools are actively going on, or they're not?
Yes, actually. The schools are going on. There are many new schools that are built, but it's not enough.
The pool of teachers is really, really very minimal, and sometimes kids get like a 12th grade education, and they become teachers because they have some knowledge. And they bring it. They bring their students up as far as they can, and they try and continue to pass the really good students up.
Exactly. Actually, that's the main shortage in Afghanistan right now. Actually, in a lot of rural areas, specifically, is women teachers, and teachers in general, actually.
So, Berkeley Bamiyan Education Foundation is a new organization.
Yes, it's a brand new organization that we've just, it's been a year that we're working, but we do have some really good volunteers who are working in Kabul and who are working in Bamiyan to put together classrooms to just help people, actually, in whatever way that we feel they can, actually. And our first priority is education, and supporting the university students and all the elementary and high school students, and supporting the teachers who really take the job of teaching 30 to 40 students in one classroom.
And is there an understanding that the people that you help, the teachers that are able to continue their education, will in turn put that training into Afghanistan? Will they stay there? I mean, a lot of people probably want to get out of Afghanistan because of the political situation.
No, actually, I think that a lot of people have returned. They just recently returned to Afghanistan to stay in Afghanistan. I don't think that they are leaving the country once they learn or once they know how to read and write, but I believe there are a lot of eager people who want to work for their community and make, you know, become teachers and, you know, go towards raising the standard of their living, actually.
And as a matter of fact, I mean, that's something that I've really noticed here, is a lot of Afghan people are very involved in what's continuing to go on there, and they do go back. We've had a lot of people on the show that have gone, that go back and forth every year. And that's really amazing to me, because many countries have a brain drain. If there's a political situation, my own country, South Africa, there was a huge brain drain after the apartheid ended. Lebanon, a lot of countries have that sense that their young people have gone elsewhere, but that seems not to be true of Afghanistan. What do you think that's about?
Well, actually, no. I think to a certain extent it was, this happened actually about 20 or 25 years ago.
The brain drain?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But right now people are going back to do something because they see the need. It's a big need, actually. For educated people who are living abroad in Europe or in the United States and everywhere, to go back. There was a majority, it was a really good consensus among Afghans here to go back and be involved in reconstruction of Afghanistan. But unfortunately, they came back after a couple of years or after two, 3 years because of the security, mm-hmm. because of lack of security. Mm-hmm. That was the main thing, that they just came back.
We're talking today with Farima Joya of the Berkeley Bamyan Education Foundation. We're getting a background in Afghanistan, what's led us to this point, and especially trying to figure out what it is that would be most helpful to the people there. What would you most want people to, our listeners, to understand about Afghanistan?
Afghanistan, or all the people in Afghanistan, they're in a situation that they are in a survival mode. Lack of security brings anything to anybody. If we don't have security here in our home, if somebody comes with a gun to our like, for instance, to our forehead and say, do whatever they want to do, you do it. So the main thing is that we have to make Afghanistan peaceful again, so people could live, actually. We cannot grow, we cannot become modernized, we cannot bring democracy in Afghanistan when there's no security. How to bring security? That's a question that, you know, we're busting our brains, actually. This is not an unsolvable problem. This is something that I believe major powers who are playing in Afghanistan, they should come to consensus. They should come to agreement who should do what in Afghanistan. Fighting and military war is not the way to do it.
So 17,000 more troops is not going to be that helpful.
I really feel sorry for anybody who's involved in the war, this side and that side. We're losing humans. We're losing young men, young souls. It's not helping anybody. It causes more chaos to fight, actually. But I'm not saying that, you know, we can do it probably completely without war or without military intervention. Mm-hmm. But military should be the minimum or minimal avenue for going forward to bring a peace or solution to Afghanistan's problem.
Someone just told me the other day, well, you know, we have to continue this war in Afghanistan because of 9/11.
This is a major, major thing that I would disagree with anybody who would say that it is because of 9/11. It's not because of 9/11. It started way before that, actually. But when the United States actually got themselves into this problem was Soviet invasion in Afghanistan. That's when actually the United States helped majorly with all the, military actions for the same people who are fighting today to go and destroy the Russians in Afghanistan. Well, they accomplished, but what did they do afterwards? They left in a midst of civil war, midst of crisis. The land is filled with mines. And then the world just turned away because they thought, they got their share. They collapsed the Soviet Union, whatever it was, the communism. Mm-hmm. To me, it was a shortcut. So right now, again, we're in a situation that if we do another shortcut, we are going to create a bigger problem. I mean, shortcuts is not going to work. So we just have to go back to the roots of the problem, why it really actually happened, mm-hmm. and how we're going to probably end it is not to leave Afghanistan alone. It's not to leave that area, that regional area that has a problem right now, not to leave it alone. Because not only we're actually fearing the fundamentalism and radicalism, it has nothing to do about Islam. Islam is a way of life, and I respect anybody whose values, anybody's, religion, to live in whatever way that they want to live. But as soon as they take a weapon and they kill somebody, that's when I'm not agreeing with them. Mm-hmm. I see a different ways rather than fighting. But, like for instance, not only I said that radicalism and fundamentalism are on the rise, actually, it's a political benefit to a group of people. So not only that, but what about the narcotics? I mean, what about the oppression of women? What about the freedom of speech that we have to have in a civil society, mm-hmm. civil war?
Yeah, I know when I start thinking about Afghanistan, I get so overwhelmed because I think of all of the young people that grew up, that a lot of these people that are so radical now grew up in refugee camps, and now we're probably going to have more refugees and more refugee camps, And then
that's exactly why we cannot leave. I mean, United States or the major powers cannot leave. The NATO, like for instance, the Europe, the English, they cannot leave Afghanistan.
Well, let's just take what's going on in the United States now. We have a huge economic crisis, and we're still forking out money all over the place. Israel, for example, gets a lot of money from the United States. But we find that we don't really have enough money to put into a place like Afghanistan where we really would really perhaps help to spend money wisely there, as you say, with education, with health care. And yet our priorities are not really that. Our priorities are to go in with as much military might as we can and try and bomb the problem away.
Well, I'm very hopeful, actually, with the new president and with the new ways that he is facing each problem that is actually coming to his way, from economy to war in Afghanistan to war in Iraq. This is my wish, actually, that he doesn't take the short way out and he just doesn't bomb his problem, but rather face it in a way that is with a long-term goal in mind, not a short-term goal. Mm-hmm. I know it costs money, but there is a less expensive way of it. He has to find it.
Let's talk more about the Berkeley Bamiyan Education Foundation so that listeners can learn more about it, perhaps get involved, put some resources towards it.
Absolutely. What we need in Berkeley Bamiyan Education is just the awareness that people in Afghanistan need education. We need all the resources as possibly that we can help the students and teachers in Afghanistan. We need support just by having a sponsorship program. Like, for instance, each project will be sponsored by someone. Other ways is donating some technologies, like, for instance, computers. Mm-hmm. We need computers, we need scanners, we need printers, we need copiers. I couldn't believe myself, actually, when somebody from the University of Bamyan emailed us and said that we have only one copier in the whole University of Bamyan. They have one textbook per classroom that each student needs to make copies for themselves, actually. They don't have a lab, an agricultural lab for their university. That is the main university of agriculture. That's the area, actually. They don't have a lab to work on. Mm. Give them an opportunity to learn and to do something. Afghans are really talented. They are really good, actually, in finding the ways to advance themselves, better their ways of life. They're talented people. They learn fast. So we just have to give them the opportunities.
What is the website?
It is bbefusa.org.
bbefusa.org.
Yes, it stands for Berkeley Bamyan Education Foundation, USA.org.
And you could also, because you have such a young organization, you could also do with some volunteers locally.
Absolutely. Well, actually, I'm more inclined to say that we need to have awareness, actually. Volunteers to just put some events together and, you know, just see what our programs are and to educate some people who really are interested in the fundamental or basic needs of what we're trying to do, actually, in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. To provide people with the least resources.
The other thing that's amazing to me, Farima, is how little money it takes to help in Afghanistan. I mean, your budget is very small, and yet your ambitions are huge, and you feel like you can accomplish those ambitions based on a small amount of money. And I think that's really important for people to understand that a dollar goes a very long way.
Exactly, exactly. That's the beauty of it, actually. Like I said, my goal is that first, I provide them with a notebook, pen, and a book. Then, if I have the money, I will buy them a chair. Actually, we don't really need a lot of fancy stuff to, you know, spend our money. There are less expensive ways to accomplish your goal.
So, bbefusa.org. Would you like to finish with anything?
Well, I thank you for having me, actually, and for the listeners that I would like to say that Afghans are very, very peaceful people, very talented people, if they had given the opportunity. And I would really like to see United States government, actually, not leaving Afghanistan by ending the war prematurely. To my mind, this is not a war. People are, unnecessarily... They are killed from both sides, actually. People who are living in the areas, you just have to open up your mind a little bit and then think in their shoes. We have a saying, like, think in their shoes. What would you do if you were in their place? Mm-hmm. Then you would probably understand what kind of people are living there. We don't have a history of 100 years or so. We have a history of 1,000 years that goes back 1,000 years. And you just have to know Afghanistan or know the area, know the culture, and know where we came from. We have a lot of patience. And in the West, especially the United States, there's the least amount of patience, actually, for anything.
It's a quick fix.
Quick fix. Everything is a quick fix.
Yeah.
But to us, quick fixes does not work, actually. It creates more problems. So I hope that we go solving this problem peacefully and with a lot of thinking, with a long-term goal in mind, rather than short fixes. And my goal is to start with educating the young people of Afghanistan, people who are really eager to learn, and to just provide them with the basic things that they require to learn. And that's the least bit that I can do from here.
Thank you, Farima Joya of Berkeley Bamiyan Education Foundation, bbefusa.org. It's where you can get in touch with Farima, and I hope that you do.
Thank you very much, Susan.
That was Farima Joya. Again, you can get in touch with the Berkeley Bamiyan Education Foundation at www.bbefusa.org. That's our show for today. Thanks for listening, and as always, views expressed are those of the host and guests and not of Stanford or KZSU Radio. Join us again next week when we will be talking to Professor Claire Brandeber of Dogush University in Istanbul. We'll go out with Michael Franti.
Colors that you fly, love just one nation, and the whole world we divide. You won't say you're sorry, there is no other choice. God bless the people now. Cannot raise their voice. We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa. Flesh and burning pain. So I sing out to the masses, stand up if you're still sane. To all of us gone crazy, I sing this one refrain. We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa, we may even find the solution to hunger and disease. We can bomb and bring